Session number 9723, Benjamin Caravan, part 1.
Where were you born, Mr. Caravan? Whereabouts?
Where was I born?
Yes.
In Liverpool, yes.
And which year was that?
1925.
What did your father do for a living?
My father worked for the London, Midland and Scottish Railway.
Doing what?
He was a driver.
What was your education?
Well, elementary education.
And how old were you when you left school?
14.
To do what?
I left school and went to work in an office.
So how did you come to be in the forces?
Well, when I was about 15, I was encouraged to join the Army Cadet Force. And I joined the Army Cadet Force in Liverpool, 87th 1st West Lancs Royal Artillery. And I was issued with a very smart uniform, known nowadays as a cheese cutter cap and a service dress tunic and riding breeches, spurs, putties and swagger stick. And of course, I went to parades and did guard duties. And this coupled with the fact that my father had always been a keen serviceman, gave me the idea of joining the army. I wanted to join the army, but I wasn't old enough at that time. And I thought of a scheme whereby I could get in. This was, in those days, we needed an employment card and a national health card. And stamps were purchased from the post office by your employer, and they were put on the card. So I went to the Ministry of Labour and I told them that I'd been working for my father and had never had employment cards, and asked them could they give me employment cards and a national health card as I'm going to start work in another firm. And they said, yes, how old are you? And I said, well, I'm 18. And they said, when were you born? So I said, the 23rd of February, 1923. So they gave me cards with that date on. And I went to the post office and I bought my own stamps. And I stamped the cards up to date. And then I took them to the recruiting office in Renshaw Hall in Liverpool, and I said I wanted to join the army. And they said, how old are you? I said, I'm 18. And they said, well, let's see your birth certificate. I said, well, I'm sorry, I haven't got one. But I have got my employment cards. And I produced the cards, which had my date of birth as 1923. So they said, right, where do you want to go? I said, well, I'd like to go into Royal Artillery. And they said, well, you're only 18. You've got to be 19 to be in the Royal Artillery. They said, the only regiment you can go in is the Young Soldiers Regiment. And they said, you've got the choice of the 70th Battalion Border Regiment or the 70th Battalion Royal Welsh Fusiliers. I said, well, makes no difference to me. I'll go in the Border Regiment. So they said, OK, can you take a medical examination now? I said, yes, and I was medically examined and had my eyesight tested, and doctor said I was A1, and they went back to the recruiting sergeant, who said, right, in 7 days' time, will you report to Dalkeith in Scotland? He wrote out a travel warrant, and I think he gave me a shilling or something, and said, make your way up there by yourself. Well, actually, when on the day that I should have travelled and I went to the station, I did meet one or two other lads of the same age, more or less, who were going up there. And we got the train and went to Dalkeith, where we met at the station, and I was in the Border Regiment. At that stage, I wasn't quite 16.
What was the initial training like?
Well, looking back, it was easy, but at that time, it was hard. Initial training was physical exercises, and route marches, drill, weapons instruction, etc., etc. But I liked it. I enjoyed it.
Were you treated abusively by the NCOs?
In no way, no. They were hard, but no way did I ever in my army career ever come across anything of that nature. I never ever heard of a sergeant, an NCO, or anything abusing anybody.
So the NCOs didn't try to humiliate the recruits?
No, in no way, no.
In words?
And most of the NCOs were peacetime soldiers who'd gone on to the reserve and had been recalled. at the beginning of the war, and they were, you know, getting up to middle age, or as I would have thought then, they were getting on a bit in years, but I think now they'd probably be in the 30s, early 40s. And a lot of them were hard, but they were kind, really. I didn't have any problems.
So they wouldn't say to the recruits that you're a lousy soldier?
Oh, they might well say that, but you took it in the spirit in which it was used. I mean, after parade, you got on with NCOs quite well. No, I never came across any bullying. And bear in mind that the 70th Battalion Border Regiment at that time had a lot of ex-postal boys in it, because I'm led to believe that at the beginning of the war, postal boys were allowed to leave the postal if they joined the forces. And there were very few regiments they could join because of the age limitation. And a lot of them found their way into the border regiment, the 70th Battalion.
Did you know them personally?
Well, I didn't at the time, but of course I got to know them, being in the same barrack room.
And they told you they'd been in Boston, did they?
Oh, yes, yes. In fact, I got some good tips on how to look after my kid.
How do you mean?
Well, they knew all the ropes, you know. I was one of the green boys. I didn't know anything about looking after your kid. And they obviously knew a great deal more than I did. And they could teach me how to hide things and look after my own stuff.
You mean prevent it from being stolen?
Yes, yes.
What were these tips?
Well, as you may know, every week there's kit inspections and you have to produce every item that you've been issued with. And if you haven't got a certain item, one way to get it was to take it off somebody else. And because there's certain items which everybody wanted, like cutlery and socks and things of that nature, and you had to know where to hide them in the barrack room so that they weren't stolen.
Where did you hide them?
Well, various hiding places in the barrack room, you know, under whatever, or in cupboards and places like that.
How did the Boston boys behave themselves? Any different from anyone else?
Well, compared with the behaviour of youngsters today, you know, they were very well behaved. Very well behaved, really. I can't see that. I don't remember of anybody being involved in any violence. I mean, I suppose everybody was in the business of stealing a bit of coal for the fire, or stealing a bit of wood, or stealing something from the cookhouse. But apart from that, there was really nothing.
Were there any skives that you can remember?
Skives? Not that I can particularly remember, no.
Where did you do your service with the Border Regiment then?
Well, I did. I joined them in Scotland, in Dalkeith, Melville Castle. There was no recognised infantry training centres in those days. You went straight to your battalion. In later days, they had infantry training centres where young soldiers went to be trained and were then posted to a battalion. But in early 1941, you went straight to battalion, and my battalion was the 70th. At Dalkeith. Well, after I'd been in the regiment for about 3 or 4 months, an infantry training centre was opened at Carlisle Castle, and I was sent to Carlisle Castle for a course which lasted about 8 weeks. And it was much the same as we had been doing already, you know, infantry drill, etc. And then, after the course, we returned to the 70th Battalion, who were then in Edinburgh. And whilst we were in Edinburgh, well, just on the outskirts of Edinburgh, I was taken ill with appendicitis. And I went home on leave, and I was taken ill at home. And I went into a hospital and had an operation for appendicitis, had my appendix removed. During which time, the battalion had moved again back to Dalkeith, to Deer Park Camp in Dalkeith. I came out of hospital and I went to a convalescent home at Crosby Hall. I had fortnight's convalescence at Crosby Hall. And then I went to the casualty clearing station at Betsy Coed. And I must have been there for about a month. And then I was returned to the 70th Battalion at Morton Hall in outside Edinburgh. Well, whilst I was at Morton Hall, No, I'm sorry. We moved from Morton Hall back to Dalkeith. And at Dalkeith, they had decided to form a street fighting school based in Edinburgh. There was a part of Leith which had been abandoned by the occupants. And this part of Leith, a slum area really, was turned into a sort of street fighting school. And I was posted to the street fighting school. And we used to teach various units street fighting, house-to-house fighting, climbing with toggle ropes, how to drop grenades down chimneys, how to storm a house, how to move a smoke screen along the street, etc., etc. And I was with the street fighter school for about 6 months.
How would you storm a house?
Well, one man would go in and take the bottom of the stairs. Another man would go in and take any rooms that were on the ground floor. And then the third man would go up to the first landing, and he would cover the next man who would go up to the top landing. And then, if possible, another man would come in and kick open a door and step back while the man that was on the landing with him would fire into the room or throw a grenade into the room. This is what we taught, anyway, at that time.
Did you ever put these techniques into practice?
No. No, this was infantry stuff. Well, they then decided that they would disband the 70th Battalion, and we were all we went to Turnhouse Aerodrome, which was an RAF Wellington operational training unit, and we had the double duty of being aerodrome guards and being tested to see if we were suitable for any other particular unit. We had intelligence tests, fitting jigsaws together, fitting puzzles together, doing exercises. And the idea was that at the end of this test, the testers could say to us, well, you're suitable for the tanks, you're suitable for the artillery, you're an engineer, etc., etc. But in the event, when I went before the colonel, who was to tell me what I was suitable for, he asked me what I wanted to do. And I said, I want to go into tanks. And he said, OK, you can go into tanks. And I was posted to the 1st 5 and 4 Fire Yeomanry.
Why did you want to go into tanks, though?
I don't know, it was just an idea. I fancied.
How was it then that you came to be in SOA?
Well, I'll come to that. When I was in the tanks, went to Morpeth in Northumberland, and I was trained as a radio operator. Well, sometime, it would be early 1943, we were on parade, a pay parade, I remember, and the squadron leader came to the parade and asked for anybody who was a wireless operator to volunteer for a special duty, and he didn't elaborate, that was it. So my friend who was stood next to me nudged me and said, come on, we'll go. So we said, we'll volunteer. And out of the parade, about 6 volunteered. And we were told that we would hear further. They took our names. And the following day, they said we had to go to Oxford, to a camp in Oxford, where we'd be tested to see if we were capable of sending and receiving Morse. So we went to this camp, and I took the test, and we returned, and I heard that that two of us had qualified as competent Morse senders.
Only two?
2 out of 6, yes. So then they said, you have to go on leave, you're going abroad, and you've volunteered to parachute into occupied territory as radio operators. So we went on leave and came back. Whilst I was on leave, the regiment moved down to Thetford in Norfolk, and I got a telegram telling me to go back to Thetford. I went to Thetford, and the same day we were moved to the Great Western Hotel in London. And in the Great Western Hotel in London, which had been taken over by the military, we were kitted out with tropical kit, and within a day or so we were taken up to Liverpool and put on a boat at Liverpool the Donata cattle, and we sailed to Port Said.
At this stage, had you been told what the objective and what your role was going to be?
No, no.
So you were totally in the dark, weren't
you? Only that we'd been told that we were going to be parachuted into enemy-occupied territory. That was all.
Had you known that you were part of SOE at that time?
No, I didn't even know what SOE was at that time. They made a great show of secrecy, and they said we were to speak to nobody about this, not even amongst ourselves. And when we were on the ship, I thought this was rather significant, that on the ship we were all called, a number of us were called into one of the ship rooms, and we were given a talk by a Greek sea captain about life in Greece. The sea captain was travelling to the Middle East on his own business, and we were led to believe that this talk was merely to keep us interested.
Were you given the opportunity to drop out at any stage?
No, no. Except on the parachute course, we were given the opportunity to decline to parachute.
So why had you volunteered originally? Was it just on the spur of the moment?
Just on the spur of the moment, yes. Out of spirit of adventure.
What was the voyage to the Far East, to the Middle East like?
Well, it was rough, very rough, until we reached the Mediterranean. It was rough weather, rough passage, rough conditions, and the ship was horrible.
In what way?
Overcrowded and no amenities whatsoever. It was a dreadful ship. I would have blown it up.
What type of amenities did you lack?
Well, when I say lack of amenities, there was the sleeping accommodation was horrendous. We were crowded into a hold. Don't know what it had been, whether it was a hold or part of the old ship's accommodation. We were each given a hammock, a rolled hammock, and we ate and slept in the one place. There were fixed tables, and the hammocks, when they were slung, they were touching one another. We were told not to get undressed, couldn't get undressed. We had to sleep with our clothes on. The food was horrible. Somebody had to go to the cookhouse and collect the food in Dixies and bring it back. And by the time they got back, it was a horrible, congealed mess. Apart from the fact that we're all seasick. Toilet facilities were minimal. Washing facilities were the same. It was really a horrible ship, and I don't think that we should have been treated in that fashion, really, although I suppose there was an expediency.
How many were in your party?
I can't remember now, about a dozen or so. But they came from various regiments, various armoured regiments. They were all armoured corps.
And all wireless operators?
All wireless operators, yes.
Can you remember any of their names?
Yes. It was Tom Higgins, Spivey. I think that's about all the names I can remember. Oh, Fulton, yes, there was a Jock Fulton. Yeah, that's all I can remember.
Was there any enemy action on the way?
Well, we were in a convoy and we heard the guns firing. But we didn't actually see anything. We heard the naval guns firing, and we did see some parachute flares, but nobody told us anything. We didn't get told what was going on. You see, you had to carry your life belt everywhere you went, and your life jacket, and you had to carry, and there was a torch attached to it, and you had to carry your hat wherever you went. And they had boat drill every day. The alarm would go and you had to make to your boat station. But you weren't given any information. Nobody told you anything.
Can you remember what the Greek told you about?
I can remember mainly about the railway system and the transport system. And about the narrow gauge railway running through southern Greece and the one line running through northern Greece, and how remote and difficult it was in the part of Greece not serviced by the railway.
Anything else that comes to mind that he said?
No, it's such a long time ago, you know. Couldn't say that I was very interested at the time, because he didn't speak very good English, and it was very hot and crowded and humid in the room we were in, so I didn't pay a lot of attention to him.
Do you remember what month you arrived in Portside?
I think it was September 43.
And what were your first impressions of Egypt?
Well, my first impression was it was very dirty. Very dirty. Everybody looked dirty to me. But of course, when we docked, all the Arab boys were there, and the Arab dock labourers were there, and Royal Engineers were chasing them about with sticks. And really, I saw a very funny incident, really. I always remember this, that they were unloading the luggage out of the hold, swinging it out over in nets. And it was going to two destinations. The luggage was labelled either Cairo or Alexandria. And as they were being put into piles, the Arab bearers were carrying, say, a suitcase or a trunk and running to the pile, and in order to remember which pile they were running to, they would repeat the name. They would say Cairo, 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 or Alex, 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 and put it in a particular pile. And I saw this one poor chap, and he was running, he was shouting Alex, 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 and he ran to the Cairo pile and put his trunk, the trunk he was carrying on his head, in the Cairo pile, and this big burly engineer with a big stick grabbed all of him and battered him with this stick and called him all kinds of names for putting him in the wrong pile. Well, afterwards found out that these poor fellows were paid about threepence a day, something of that nature, for doing this work, and as well as the ignominy of having to labour for threepence a day, they got knocked about by the engineers on the quayside.
Did you have much to do with the Egyptian population?
No, very little, very little. When we caught the train to Cairo, and we got off at Cairo main station, and I think we went by tram to Abbasiyah barracks on the outside of Cairo.
What did the attitude of the Egyptians towards British forces seem to be? Were you able to tell?
Well, I thought they were rather friendly, really, in so much as that they were in a position to profit from our presence.
Did they?
Oh yes, no doubt about that. They profited to the extent that we bought a lot of their goods, and we obviously gave them what money we could in various ways. I'm quite sure they were happier with us than without us.
So, did you never come across any hostility from Egyptians?
I never personally came across any, no. No.
Or any feeling that you weren't welcome?
No, I never got that impression of the Egyptians.
What's happened to you in Egypt? Was it further training?
No, well, we went to Abbasiyah barracks, and coming from Great Britain, which was in the midst of the war with blackouts and shortages, coming to Abbasiyah was really an eye-opener, because there was a lot of everything that we were short of in England. There was fruit, which we, you know, we'd missed, and there was cigarettes in abundance, and there was everything that we'd missed, and there wasn't a blackout. Well, there wasn't an enforced blackout. And it was quite a nice life in Abbasiyah barracks. We didn't have any duties to do, and it was warm and pleasant, and we had about 2 or 3 weeks in Abbasiyah barracks. And then we were taken to a unit in Palestine called ME-102, and that was on Mount Carmel in Haifa.
What happened there?
Now, that was a wireless training school. Right, and we were divided into classes, and we started basically learning radio operating from the beginning again, but with different sets. And we learned ciphers, how to encipher and decipher messages, and we learned how to charge batteries, and we learned how to repair charging engines. And that the course was a couple of months, about 8 weeks, I think. And at the end of the course, we were then taken out. I was taken out in a truck with a broken generator and a broken radio set. And I was taken out into the hills in Palestine. I don't know exactly where we were, but I was left with the broken radio set and the broken charging engine and a flat battery and some tins of bully beef and some biscuits and some tea. And I was told as soon as I'd mended the charging engine and I got the battery on charge and I'd mended the wireless set, I could come up on the air on a given frequency and he'd come and pick me up. And if I didn't get it going, well, too bad. But fortunately, before this had happened, I was quite friendly with the sergeant who was in charge of the battery shop, and he told me what faults to look for in the charging engine when my time came to take this test. So, of course, when I took the test, I got the charging engine going within minutes. I had the battery on charge. When the battery on charge, I just went through the circuit in the set and found a cut lead and soldered the lead up or joined the lead up. And I was able to make contact, and I was picked up the same day.
What if you hadn't been tipped off? Do you think you would have found the fault easily?
Well, I think I would have found it. Yes. Because they weren't complicated machines. It was just a little engine with a, you know, carburetor and what have you, and a generator. Little petrol-driven engine. You see them now in the streets. The council use them for pumping water out of drains. Char horse, it was called.
Called what?
Char horse, C-H-A-R-H-O-U-S-E, char horse charging engine.
Did anybody fail the test, to your knowledge?
No, I think they ensured that everybody qualified. I mean, to begin with, we all knew Morse code. We could receive and send messages, and that was the basic of it, if you could receive and send messages.
It doesn't really sound a very serious test.
Well, we were tested, before that, we were tested with our sending and receiving and our deciphering, you know, in the classroom. We had to qualify in the classroom. This was a practical test. And having completed that practical test, we were then sent to what were known as outstations. We had certain houses, one in Tel Aviv, that I went to, and one at Nathania. And you went to this house, and you had a radio set, and a charging engine, and a battery. And you lived in the house, and you made daily contact with headquarters. You had various schedules during the day, and you had to send and...